stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Israeli police say a truck rammed into a group of soldiers Sunday in Jerusalem, killing four of them all in their 20s. Officials say 15 soldiers were wounded in the attack, including two who were critically injured. Speaking at the scene of the attack, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the attacker has been identified, and according to all the signs, he was a supporter of the Islamic State. He said Israel has blockaded Jabal Makaber, the East Jerusalem neighborhood where the truck driver lived. He went on to say, I send my condolences to the family and also, of course, my best wishes to the wounded. We will overcome this terror just as we overcame other attacks, and there is a list of actions that I will not detail here now that we will need to take in order to ensure that these incidents will not repeat themselves and that we can deal with them when they do. The suspect in the deadly shooting at an airport in the U.S. state of Florida has been charged with what is called an act of violence resulting in death. 26-year-old Esteban Santiago is an Iraq War veteran, accused of killing five people and wounding six others.
Indications are that he came here to carry out this horrific attack. We have not identified any triggers that would have caused this attack. But again, it's very early in the investigation, and we're pursuing all angles and what prompted him to carry out such a horrific attack.
George Pirro is the FBI agent in charge of the investigation. The airport did shut down after Friday's attack and gradually reopened Saturday with reports of security delays. This is VOA News. The Taliban has dismissed American plans to send an extra 300 troops to Afghanistan's southern Helmand province as nothing but an attempt to lend morale. Meantime, senior American diplomat Thomas Shannon has assured Afghan leaders that Washington's commitment to their country will continue under the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump. Shannon was in Kabul. He did tell reporters that the purpose of the visit was to underscore the strong partnership between the two countries. Around 8,500 American troops are in Afghanistan, training, advising, and assisting local forces in their battle against the resurgent Taliban. Nigeria's president is saying that his government is not resting in its efforts to find the remaining Chibok girls that are still held captive by the militant group Boko Haram. Muhammadu Buhari said that they're marking the 1,000th day of the girls' abduction. And he said in Twitter that I am hopeful soon that the community, Nigeria, and indeed the world, will welcome the remaining girls back home. President Buhari also commended the country's security agencies for their role in rescuing some of the girls. An activist group campaigning for the return of the girls, Bring Back Our Girls, started 1 week of activities to mark the 1,000 days of the girls' abduction. Last week, Nigerian soldiers found one of the girls. An official with the U.S. consulate in Guadalajara, Mexico, has been shot and wounded. Authorities are trying to identify a suspect. No motive is known for the shooting. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation is offering a $20,000 reward for information leading to a suspect's arrest. A cold wave across Europe has left at least a dozen people dead in the past 2 days, including several migrants and homeless people, with frigid temperatures expected to continue in coming days. Five Portuguese tourists were killed and 27 others injured Sunday when their bus crashed off an icy highway in central France before dawn on what is locally known as the Road of Death. The 40-seat bus was on its way to Switzerland. According to authorities, it appeared that the driver lost control of the vehicle because of ice on the road. 10 victims on the cold perished in Poland, where temperatures were as low as minus 14 degrees Celsius. In Italy, the cold has been blamed for 7 deaths, including 5 homeless people, 2 of them Polish nationals. A huge explosion ripped through the center of rebel-held border town in northern Syria, killing more than 40 people, many of them civilians displaced by months of conflict that devastated large parts of the nearby city of Aleppo. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We must create wealth and restore happiness to our nation. We can only do this when we have an educated and skilled population.
Expectations are high as President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo begins his first term in office.
I hope they are going to look at the facts being discussed on the ground in Gambia, that the elections were fraud, and that President Jammeh, when he conceded defeat, conceded it on an initial result.
The Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS, says it will soon take a decision on the Gambia.
La grande inquiétude que nous avons est le grand changement en termes d'évolution.
She says their highest worry is the increasing number of people vulnerable to food insecurity and malnutrition.
And humanitarian challenges in Cameroon mount as refugees continue to flow in from neighboring countries. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Expectations are high as Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo has now been sworn into office. Ghanaians want an end to current economic hardship. For VOA, Francis Kakakra-Forsing has more from the capital, Accra.
Nana Akufo-Addo was sworn into office Saturday before Parliament, fellow presidents from the continent, dignitaries, and thousands of Ghanaians at the Black Star Square. The inauguration ceremony was colorful, as many Ghanaians adorned themselves in traditional outfits from kente, a popular woven cloth from southern Ghana, and fugu from the north. But an arduous task lays ahead for the new president, who inherits a weak economy with an increasing debt, high inflation, plummeting commodities prices, and the city's free fall. President Akufo-Addo, in his inaugural speech, promised prosperity for all Ghanaians.
We must create wealth and restore happiness to our nation. We can only do this when we have an educated and skilled population that is capable of competing in the global economy. We must expand our horizons and embrace science and technology as critical tools for our development. We will provide vision and direction and shine the light down the path of our entrepreneurs and farmers. We are indeed counting on a vibrant private sector to drive growth and create jobs.
Some young Ghanaians are highly expectant of the prospects of an Akufo-Addo government. Salifu Fatau, a salesperson, says jobs must be top priority.
For the young people, we need work. We need work and good salary. We are looking on him to see to it that he's able to build a lot of schools, a lot of works for we the youth. For now, he has given us his word, so we are standing on his word.
Fadila to Ahmed, a draft woman, is concerned about the economy.
I'm expecting the government or our new president to work towards the economy. But that's my main reason why I voted for him. The economy is very bad. When you look at the value of our money, it's very low. The fire crisis, the do-for-do-son issue is enough. We had enough.
Faustina Dugbevi hopes for lower education fees.
I want the education cost to be at least a bit lower, that everybody can send his or her daughter to school and pay school fees.
The tenure of outgoing President John Mahama saw widespread corruption scandals and apparent shielding of accused officials. The new president sounded a warning against corruption under his government.
I shall protect the public purse by insisting on value for money in all transactions. Public service is just that. Service and not an avenue for making money. Money is to be made in the private sector, not the public. And measures will be put in place to ensure this.
Meanwhile, on social media, President Akufo-Addo has been accused of using bits of former U.S. President George W. Bush's speech as his own in his inaugural address. The director of communication at the presidency issued an apology. Francisca Kakra-Forsen for VOA News, Accra.
Kwaku Bopri, or KB Asante, is a Ghanaian retired diplomat, writer, and statesman. He was the secretary to Ghanaian first president, Osagyefo for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. KB Asante also served under most heads of state in Ghana. Earlier, I reached him in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, via telephone link-up and asked what African countries can learn from such a smooth transfer of power.
It went very well. Before the inauguration, the incumbent graciously conceded, as we expected to do. And in my opinion, that is a Ghanaian tradition. Stemming back way out when we had the Ashanti and other kingdoms, what was decided by the state went. It was followed by the Otumfuo or the chief and so on. So to me, what happened was in consonance with our tradition, and I was very proud that it happened, especially at a time when another African country was refusing to accept election results.
Looking at the smooth transitional process, some people are saying this is one of the golden standards of Africa's democracy worth emulating. What is your take on that?
Yes, it is. Yes, we are emulating, yes. But I maintain that it is the African tradition. We don't change chiefs or heads with violence or any unpleasant consequences and so on. This, you see, it is not generally realized that we were. It is generally realized that this so-called democracy which came to Europe from Greece and then which was transported to Africa actually made our nation believe in the so-called democracy and its aftermath and processes. I don't share that view. Democracy is a growing concern. In Ghana, for example, the women had the vote before the British, who were here to teach our democracy, had the vote, and so on. So our credentials are good, and we have just gone on with the process as in accordance with our traditions and with accordance with modern practices.
What do you think founding president, whom you work with, Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah's reaction will be with this latest democratic victory that Ghana has chalked so far? And how proud will he be looking at Ghana from a continental perspective, or how disappointing he might feel if he looks at what is happening on the continent?
Yes, he will be happy at what has happened in Ghana, that we have changed our method of government without any violence and so on. But I think he would be very much disappointed at what is happening in West Africa, and especially in Africa, because all over Africa we have problems of governance, of succession, of ethnic groups being against another group and so on. And what Nkrumah envisaged, as you know, was a united Africa. And I think that will greatly disappoint him. And in fact, it will greatly disappoint me. In fact, I don't think we can make good progress with the present state of affairs in other African countries where governments do not accept the way of changing governments or people who run the show. They're trying to perpetuate their rule against the will of the people.
How was it like working with Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah?
I was excited. When I look back, I think I was lucky to working with him. I did know him before. I wasn't a member of the party, as many people think. It was late George Fatwa who recommended me that I knew about the African problems and I could help. And I went to his office. So I left Tel Aviv earlier than I should have left. Then went to his office and he said, "This is your chair. You stay here and work with me." And that was as simple as that. And we got on very well eventually. When I went there at first, as usual, I'm a talkative. I was a teacher before. I talked too much. And my boss, Igdo Koku, who was secretary to the cabinet and head of the civil service, called me and advised me to take it easy and not to talk when so many people were there and wait until I was alone. I was alone with him and I couldn't say anything. And I did. and I learned a lot from him and how he managed affairs of the country and what he wanted to do in Ghana. And in fact, I learned to respect him even more. And as we say, some say in Ghana, I became what you call an Nkrumahist.
Kweku Bapri Okebi Asante is a Ghanaian retired diplomat, writer, and statesman. He spoke with me from Accra. The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, says it will soon take a decision on Gambia. This following President Yahya Jammeh's refusal to hand over power, citing voter irregularities in the last presidential election. But Samsudeen Sarr, the Gambian deputy permanent representative to the UN, told me ECOWAS is wrong in its call for Mr. Jammeh to hand over power.
We're still waiting for that decision. We don't know exactly what it is. To start speculating would not help at all. But I hope they are going to look at the facts being discussed on the ground in Gambia, that the elections were flawed, and that President Jammeh, when he conceded defeat, conceded it on an initial result that he thought were all final and okay.
The chairman of the Electoral Commission has run away, absconded to neighboring Senegal for the fear of his life.
No, it's not the fear of his life. He can't explain this number. If they call him in the court and ask him, what is nobody touching him? The whole country are checked with everybody. Nobody threatened this man. This man may not even know that somebody manipulated this number before him. He left the country because he knew, if you were to sit with me on this table and look at this number, Peter, if you are honest to yourself and you know it's simple arithmetic, you know these things don't add up. So it is a matter of some serious manipulation of the number, which gave us the cue. Because when they call back and say, look, the second results are here, we are sorry, the first results were wrong, we have changed it. Now, can you sign here and agree that the second results are okay? We said, no, we're going to take a look at it. We went and took a look for the first time, reviewed the whole system, and saw there was more fraud than only this number.
Ghana just installed a new president. Many people have said that this is a golden standard for Africa's democracy and that Gambia could have looked at this example. Why is Gambia going the opposite direction, if I may ask you?
No. It's not the opposite direction unless you are aligning yourself with the same idea that there was no fraud, there were no flaws, and I don't think Ghana would have transitioned smoothly like this. If 5 days after the election results were read, the Electoral Commission came back and said, look, we made a mistake in our numbers and drastically reduced the numbers and wanted the opposition party to bow to it like that. It would not have gone that way. No country has ever gone through this. Let's be realistic. If it was a smooth and straightforward thing, as people like most of who are anti-government, Ghana government, again, that, well, he admitted, conceded, and came and changed his mind without reason, which is false. That's false.
The president, Yahya Jammeh, has petitioned the Supreme Court, which has not heard any case for some time now. The petition is supposed to be heard on January 10th. Does that mean that ECOWAS that says that the members will be present at the installation of Adama Barrow as the next president will not happen, and there could be a possible clash if plans to install Adama Barrow as the legitimate president of the Gambia goes ahead, and Yahya Jammeh will prevent that from happening?
Apparently, the Supreme Court you talk about, everybody is questioning even its credibility, just like they used to question the credibility of the IEC, the Independent Electoral Commission. In 2014, armed attack was organized into the country to bring the government down because they said the Electoral Commission is unfair. In April 2016, demonstration was, they said the Electoral Commission is for Yahya Jammeh. Even before the election, they said Yahya Jammeh gave the Electoral Commission $450,000 to share, so the Electoral Commission cannot be fair. So if the Electoral Commission had come on the 2nd of December and said Jammeh won, the whole Gambia, including the world, would have supported the fact that the Electoral Commission is corrupt. But the Electoral Commission came and said Jammeh lost on a very questionable election. And the whole world said that's the perfect Electoral Commission the whole world should be looking for. It's the same thing they are saying about the Supreme Court judges. They are all saying, oh, it cannot be fair. Oh, this man, these are people, Jammeh. Until perhaps they come and say, we have looked at the figures, Jammeh. Apparently, it looks like still this guy won.
then that is the time they're going to say, oh, this is the best Supreme Court. Where are we standing in this whole argument?
Samsudeen Sarr is the Gambian Deputy Permanent Representative to the UN. He spoke with me from New York. Humanitarian challenges continue to mount in Cameroon as refugees continue to flow in from Nigeria and the Central African Republic. The government and the United Nations are concerned about acute food shortages in the year to come. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka has this story from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
The number of officially registered refugees in Cameroon has climbed to about 500,000, with fresh arrivals coming from both Nigeria and the Central African Republic. That's in addition to the over 200,000 people registered as internally displaced by the Boko Haram conflict. But Najat Rushdie, coordinator of United Nations aid efforts in Cameroon, says the acute numbers of refugees and displaced people are much higher. Some people are still being registered, while others have sought shelter outside of camps. The UN estimates the total number of refugees and displaced people in Cameroon to be as many as 1.6 million and warns that the number could climb to as high as 2.7 million. But the government and the UN say $310 million is needed over the next 3 years to meet the needs.
La grande inquiétude que nous avons est le grand changement en termes d'évolution.
She says the highest worry is the increasing number of people vulnerable to food insecurity and malnutrition, since more than 2 million people are already exposed to food insecurity. She says on Cameroon's northern border, where Nigerian refugees are found, there have been unpredictable long dry seasons, floods and unfavorable climate conditions that have hurt farmers. She says such factors are having direct impacts on the humanitarian situation of refugees and displaced persons, so they have to look for means to handle it now. Armed groups continue to operate freely in the Central African Republic, in particular in the countryside. Not only do refugees not want to return home, but as many as 20,000 more have arrived in the past 10 months. And Cameroonian authorities have warned that despite recent military successes against Boko Haram, the war against the terrorists is not over. Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration, René Emmanuel Sadi, says host populations near the border with Nigeria are abandoning their farms for fear of insurgent attacks. That has aggravated the food crisis.
Nous avons à nouveau pensé mettre en place le plan de réponse.
He says Cameroon is counting on international donors, friendly countries and the UN to execute the emergency response plan it has prepared to take care of both refugees and internally displaced persons. The Boko Haram insurgency, now in its 8th year, has spilled over to Cameroon, Chad and Niger. According to the United Nations, more than 25,000 people have lost their lives and over 2 million have been displaced. Moki, Edwin Kinzuka, for VOA News, Yaoundé.
South Africa's Mervyn Davies has won an international reputation as a maker of fine-stringed musical instruments, including guitars, banjos and violins. His works are very different from classic conventional designs, but Davies says they are still based on the beauty of the early masters' builders. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports in the final installment of a series on a few of South Africa's master crafters.
Mervyn Davies strums his smooth talker guitar. Musicians around the world say its sound is different to any other. One, the luthier, or guitar maker, is working on at the moment, has a tan body contrasting with a dark, almost purple color. Davies makes his smooth talkers from hard African kiat wood.
It's available abundantly. It's also very, very stable, and it's got a brilliant tone to it. Kiat is a bit lighter in weight, so it's got a bit mellower tone. But having said that, It's the luthier's job to translate that into the instrument that he's building. I was always curious about coming up with something that I could call my own, and so I always experimented. When you work experimentally, you somehow have to make it pleasing to the eye still.
Davis is in his 60s, tanned and lithe, with long silver hair. He's been making stringed instruments since he was a child.
So it's been a passion all my life. I can't even remember when it started, but my parents told me that as a kid, they couldn't get me away from guitar shops. I made petrol can guitars like African kids do, and it developed from there. It just got a bit more real every time.
Davis planes wood for a guitar in his workshop in the bush near the town of Bruderstroom in South Africa's northwest province. He says he made his first proper stringed instrument, a mandolin, when he was 14. He was inspired by his father, who made one while imprisoned in a POW camp in Italy during the Second World War.
And then he escaped one day, took the mandolin with him, and finally the mandolin got left in the attic of a farm building where he was hiding for the Germans and had to run for his life, and the mandolin got left behind. And I think for any little boy, that is a story that would capture his imagination.
When he was a student, he made his first two classical guitars, one for a friend.
The one I made for myself, I ended up selling in a pawn shop to get petrol money to get back home for December holidays.
Davis studied architecture, but demand for his instruments rose so much that he gave it up to pursue his musical passion. He says he's always been very experimental.
The ergonomics of the instrument is one that I always felt that I could possibly find different solutions for. Things like access to the neck higher up than a traditional guitar yields. So it's about playability. And the minute you start fiddling with that, the proportions of the instrument changes. Some of my guitars are very trebly, and that very much is a matter of taste. Some people don't like that at all. Other people, and I'd say more people that play lead, like the treble power of guitars.
Davis's desire to innovate is evident in almost every instrument he makes, like his double-necked 12-string acoustic guitars. Some of South Africa's top musicians use Davis's creations. Guitarist Blackie Swart plays the classic composition Apache by The Shadows.
Blackie being known as a popular artist, but he's one of the greatest guitar players in the country and deserves a lot more credit than he's been given.
But artists around the world use his instruments, including one acknowledged as one of the best ever banjo players, America's Bella Fleck. Davis says the most fascinating part of building guitars and banjos is the actual voicing of the instruments. He follows a process unlike most other luthiers.
That is the luck I have, that had taken me years and years of writing letters and to retailers and people not being interested and this, that and the other.
But supreme skill rather than luck is responsible for Davis's craft, and in his admittedly small way, success has arrived. Some of his guitars are distributed by the Groon Guitar Company in one of the globe's great music capitals, Nashville, exposing Davis's instruments to more of the world's great musicians. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a discussion on the challenges of political transitions in Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania, and Gambia, to name a few. Right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the Africa Cup of Nations. The 31st edition of the Africa Cup of Nations kicks off on January 14th in Gabon, with the host taking on Guinea-Bissau and Burkina Faso taking on Cameroon. Here are the groups in the tournament. In Group 1, there is Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Gabon, and Guinea-Bissau. In Group 2, there is Algeria, Senegal, Tunisia, and Zimbabwe. Group 3 has DR Congo, Ivory Coast, Morocco, and Togo. And the last group has Egypt, Mali, Ghana, and Uganda. The tournament will be held in Libreville, Franceville, Oyem, and Port-Gentil. The final will be held on February 5th, 2017. The 2017 African champion will qualify for the 2017 FIFA Confederations Cup in Russia. This year's event is also part of the Africa Cup of Nations 60th anniversary. In golf, Tiger Woods has committed to his first event of 2017 by agreeing to play in the Genesis Open in February at the Riviera Country Club in Los Angeles. This is where it all started for him. It was his first PGA Tour event when he was only 16. Woods, who will also host the event, has not played in it since 2006. The 40-year-old finished 15th at the Hero World Challenge in December after 15 months out through injury. And in boxing, Badou Jack and James DeGaulle meet in Super Middleweight World Championship Unification Showdown on Saturday, January 14th in New York City. WBC Super Middleweight World Champion Badou Jack and IBF Super Middleweight World Champion James DeGaulle will look to stake their claim as the best 168-pound fighter in the world when they meet in the title unification clash. Badou Jack, who fights out of Las Vegas, captured the WBC 168-pound crown with a 12-round majority decision over previously unbeaten defending champion Anthony Dirrell last April. A former amateur standout who represented Gambia in the 2008 Olympics, Jack retained his belt against former world title challenger George Groves last September on the undercard of Floyd Mayweather's final fight. Jack was an underdog against both Dirrell and Groves before retaining his title. The 6'1", 33-year-old won 4 in a row leading up to his controversial draw against Butte in April. Meanwhile, James DeGaulle won the vacant IBF belt in his U.S. debut last May by dropping Andre Dirrell twice on his way to an unanimous decision. The 2008 Olympic gold medalist from London then successfully defended it last November in a thrilling shootout with the hometown favorite and former titleist Butte. The 30-year-old, whose only blemish came in a majority decision in his 11th bout against then-unbeaten Groves, will make his fourth consecutive start outside his native England as he looks to become a global power and a unified champion at 168 pounds. And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Tell them, send them go down. We send them go down. Tell them say you dey. Tell them say you dey. Tell you never. Tell them say you dey.
I know more cry. attention to your bus stop. They got to take, so I got to space. You feeling my vibes, just make a difference.
Get music, get yourself music. Try for a friend and make us a life. It's not easy, man. I see them making crazy like we see. But me, the doctor, I am the Chris man, the rhythm.
I am like the sun. You can never give me my light, oh. Something that they can see. They gon' take it from me yesterday, but my tomorrow is gonna be a better day.
A larger, say they go tire, then go Alanu, and I'm a Juba. They go me better, me they want to buy.
One day with them go come.
Election number one.
Election on top of them all.
No go ever run down.
Stand up and fight for this miracle. And now I name it, someone's coming. But I got an honor, so stand up and fight for this miracle.
Hey, Imano Dirizio, yeah, Imano
banker last na bagam. My check in all the bounce. My mansion all na badam. Baby, take a look around. My banker last na bagam. My check in all the bounce. My mansion all na badam. Make you take a look around.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As we witness Africa's progress towards a more robust democratic dispensation, it will be of some interest to look at three cases which exemplify the twist and turn of Africa's progress towards democracy. Yesterday, in Accra, Ghana, the new president, Nana Akufo-Addo, was inaugurated in a colorful ceremony. This is a very good example of a peaceful transition of administration in Ghana, replacing President John Mahama. What we learned from the Ghanaian situation is that the people of Ghana were not pleased with the performance of President Mahama's government. And that is why it was such a massive victory for his party. But it is also a warning that if he fails to deliver what he has promised to the people of Ghana, he might also face the fate of President Mahama. This is why it is important to have periodic elections in a two-term democratic constitution. Now, when we look at the Democratic Republic of the Congo, we see a drawback. That is the tendency of African presidents to want to prolong their rule beyond what is set in the constitution. President Joseph Kabila has tried every means to prolong his stay, but he was up against very strong opposition from political parties and from civil society. Even when he tried to use a rump of the opposition to prolong his rule, the opposition was too strong. Unfortunately, the Roman Catholic Church intervened and successfully arranged an agreement that provides for a transitional arrangement. Under that arrangement, President Kabila will remain as head of state, but in a diminished situation, which means that the opposition, the Rassemblement, headed by the veteran opposition leader, Tshisekedi, will have to provide a prime minister and will have to arrange for election this year, 2017, and that President Kabila will not contest the election. Unfortunately, there are opposition people who are not so convinced that President Kabila will honor the agreement. The reason being that while his party has signed on to the agreement, he himself has not done so. In a meeting with the Catholic Church, he merely said that the church should remain engaged to ensure the full implementation of the agreement. But what is very important is that the Security Council of the United Nations has endorsed the agreement and has given it international legitimacy. Let us hope that the wiser council will allow President Kabila to move ahead with this transitional arrangement. The Gambia gives us another interesting case. After the elections in December, President Jaja Game surprised not only the Gambians but the international community when he welcomed his defeat, called the winner, Mr. Adama Barrow, and promised to work with him in a transitional arrangement. Few days, however, he changed his mind. He said that figures have been changed, and he called for the election to be declared null and void and for new elections. He later realized that it was not in his power to do that and made an appeal to the Supreme Court of the Gambia. Now, they have now succeeded in filling the seats for the Supreme Court, and tomorrow, Monday, the Supreme Court will hear the case. It is important that ECOWAS and the African Union, as well as the Security Council, be prepared to deal with whatever the Supreme Court might say. It seems that there are three options open to the Supreme Court of the Gambia. One, they could argue that President Jame was too late in making the appeal, yet that he has exceeded the time limit in the Constitution. The second option might well be that the Supreme Court might say that even though figures may have changed, they have not materially changed the outcome, and reaffirm that Mr. Adama Barrow has been elected as the new president. And the third and more serious outcome could be that the Supreme Court might agree with President Jame that the elections should be declared null and void and to have new elections. It will be very important that ECOWAS be prepared to deal with these three contingencies, because to ignore whatever the Supreme Court might say will not be worthwhile, particularly when one is discussing the possibility of an armed intervention. So let's see what happens in the Gambia, but very grateful that what happened in Ghana and also appeal to President Kabila to honor the agreement reached under the auspices of the Catholic Church. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 80 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, and Engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, covetousness is the father of unfulfilled desires. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is making human rights and fighting corruption a national economic security priority, said Deputy National Security Advisor for International Economics, Adewale Adeyemo. Under the National Action Plan on Responsible Business Conduct, the U.S. is encouraging companies to embrace high standards for responsible business conduct. Responsible Business Conduct, or RBC, is based on the idea that businesses can do well while doing good work. In other words, businesses can play an important role in contributing to global economic and social progress. Governments can do their part by helping to set the standards and expectations for responsible business conduct to take place. The National Action Plan underscores the U.S. commitment to work with businesses around the world to fight corruption, promote transparent practices, raise labor standards, respect human rights, and combat human trafficking. American companies are already among the global leaders in this area and are widely recognized for their commitment to promoting human rights, respecting the rule of law, and strengthening the communities where they do business. For companies investing overseas, corruption is a significant barrier that impedes business and economic growth, said Mr. Adeyemo. To address these serious concerns, President Barack Obama developed the National Action Plan to enhance coordination within the U.S. government, push for higher standards globally, and strengthen public-private cooperation to help U.S. companies attain their responsible conduct goals. Under the National Action Plan, the U.S. intends to continue to refine the ways in which it purchases goods and services and finances overseas activities. The U.S. will work with companies, civil society, and foreign governments to share best practices and support high standards. The U.S. National Action Plan will continue to be an important foreign policy tool in the effort to promote human rights and fight corruption.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.